Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 30th of December, these are our main stories. The US military says it struck five militia bases in Iraq and Syria, targeting an Iranian-backed group it blames for the killing of an American contractor. President Trump has called for unity to eradicate the scourge of anti-Semitism after a knife attack on Jews in New York State. Ukrainian soldiers released in a prisoner swap with pro-Russian rebels have been given a hero's welcome in Kiev. Also in this podcast...
It's Big Ben!
As the UK gets ready for New Year's Eve, our correspondent comes face-to-face with its biggest star. The US military says it's carried out a series of attacks in Iraq and Syria on an Iraqi-based militia group that's said to be backed by Iran. The targets included weapons stores and command and control facilities. The Pentagon said the action was in retaliation for the killing of a US contractor. I heard more from our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston.
This is significant. Here you have the Americans saying they've gone after an Iraqi militia group that is linked to Iran. According to the Americans, the militiamen have repeatedly received lethal aid and other support from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. According to a Pentagon statement, the Americans hit the Kataib Hezbollah organization in, as you say, five places, three of them in Iraq and two in Syria, going after weapons stores and command and control facilities, hoping to degrade the militiamen, make them less capable of carrying out attacks, because the background to this is the Americans blame Kataib Hezbollah for a series of attacks on bases in Iraq that the Americans use. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned recently that if the attacks continued, there would be a decisive American response. Then 2 days ago, there was a large attack on a base near the Iraqi city of Kirkuk, 30 rockets raining down, one U.S. civilian contractor killed and several U.S. servicemen injured. And today we've seen that military response from the Americans.
And what about response to the American action? Anything yet?
The organization on the receiving end of this, Kataib Hezbollah, hasn't spoken itself, but we see Iraqi security sources saying that the organization had four of its fighters killed and about 30 wounded, some of them seriously. And the question is now, how will the militia react? Will it, as the Americans hope, be deterred and rather cowed, or is it possible that it might hit back, that it might target those bases again? And I'm quite sure that this will be a nervous time for those American troops in those bases scattered across Iraq. We're yet to hear too from the Iraqi government. The Americans have attacked Iraqis in Iraq. How will the Iraqi government respond to this?
Our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston. Hundreds of political prisoners have been reunited with their families in Ukraine as government authorities and Russian-backed separatists attempt to de-escalate Europe's only active war. The prisoner swap was agreed by the Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky earlier this month and implemented on Sunday. One of those newly released prisoners spoke to the media after her release.
I went to visit my parents, and the self-proclaimed Lugansk People's Republic decided by a military court that I should receive 12 years for high treason. I have a child at home. I have something to live for. I have really been looking forward to this day.
Our reporter Zhanna Bepashtuk spoke to me from Kyiv Airport.
The released Ukrainian prisoners have just arrived with this aircraft after being imprisoned in the rebel-held territories of the Donbas in eastern Ukraine. They are seeing their relatives for the first time in 2, 3, and some even 5 years. This is a highly emotional moment, and of course it is the best possible New Year gift for the families. But Ukraine's government has paid a high price for it in return for own civilians and servicemen. It has handed over those charged with terrorist attacks and deaths of peaceful protesters. Many Ukrainians say that this is a prisoner exchange on Russia's terms.
Zhanna Bepashtuk with me from Kyiv. Now for some analysis on this story, I've been speaking to our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders. I asked Mike whether this prisoner swap could lead to a lasting peace deal.
I think that is going a bit too far at the moment. I mean, Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, when he was being elected in March and April, he made resolving the crisis in eastern Ukraine one of his top priorities. Now, he has covered a lot of ground to do that. He revived what are known as the Normandy format talks. Now, this is talks between Russia, Ukraine, France and Germany to sort out the peace agreements, the Minsk agreements that were about getting a ceasefire in place in eastern Ukraine. And he managed to get that meeting sorted out. So there was one earlier this month, and that meeting paved the way for this prisoner release. But it's not gone down entirely well in Ukraine itself.
Because some people are saying he's so keen to say he's fixed it, he's giving away too much and doing it too quickly.
Absolutely. There's the asymmetric nature of the exchange, first of all. More prisoners were released by Ukraine to the rebel side than vice versa. It's the nature of the kind of prisoners that were released as well. Some of the people that the rebels released were simply family members who'd been arrested visiting relatives in the rebel-held areas, and they've been in prison for sort of, as Jana said, for several years. Those are the kind of people that were being sent back to Ukraine. Conversely, among the prisoners that Ukraine has released are five members of the Berkut, which are the Ukrainian riot police, or former members. Now, they were held on suspicion of having opened fire on crowds in the pro-democracy demonstrations in 2014. And when I say open fire, I'm talking about snipers and shotguns. So there's a lot of anger, really, by some people that those people are being released.
Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders. President Trump has urged Americans to come together to eradicate anti-Semitism after five people were wounded in a knife attack on Jews celebrating Hanukkah in New York State. The suspected attacker, named as Grafton Thomas, has appeared in court to be charged with five counts of attempted murder. Eyewitnesses described how the assailant burst into a rabbi's house in Monzi on Saturday night, slashing and stabbing people with a large bladed weapon. Joseph Gluck was there when the attack happened.
He came in wielding a big knife, sword, machete, I don't know what it was, and started hitting people right and left. He came into the dining room, hit people there, he hit somebody in the kitchen, and then he came back to the dining room. That's when I tried to have him run after me. He didn't go, so I came back and I threw a coffee table at the guy, and then he started to come after me. He walked out the door and he started to scream, "Hey you, I'll get you," and I screamed for everybody to move away, that all the people shouldn't get hurt. Outside, I was just trying that he shouldn't go into the synagogue. I know that was my line of defense, that once he goes into the synagogue, nobody knows what could happen there. I didn't know how many people were in the synagogue, so I just want to make sure that, God forbid, he shouldn't go into the synagogue. He came towards the synagogue, he tried one door, he saw that it was locked, he didn't pull the door actually. He went to the next door, he didn't go inside, because he also saw people locked in the front of his nose. He went to his car and drove away.
New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo described Saturday night's attack in this way.
It is domestic terrorism. These are people who intend to create mass harm, mass violence, generate fear based on race, color, creed. That is the definition of terrorism. And just because they don't come from another country doesn't mean that they're not terrorists. And they should be prosecuted as domestic terrorists, because that's what they are.
Jacob Kornblush of the Jewish Insider website has told us the area has seen a dramatic rise in anti-Semitic incidents, especially in recent weeks.
We're talking about drawing of swastikas on social media. But in recent weeks, we've just seen an outburst of violent attacks where we're talking about people getting punched in their face, people getting mugged, screamed at. We're talking about people being beaten up in broad daylight. Just in the past week, there's been reported at least 9 anti-Semitic attacks. There's no real reason given by authorities as to what sparked that, and there's no real measures being implemented, at least short-term, to prove the community that not only would the perpetrators be brought to justice, but also that Orthodox Jews who are visibly Jewish, who look Jewish, that they would feel protected to walk on the street, to walk to a local synagogue with a kippah on their head. This is not something that we are used to because mostly, okay, we live in neighborhoods where crime is relatively low and also a large segment of the community live together.
Jacob Kornblush of the Jewish Insider. Our correspondent in the US, Chris Buckler, is following this story for us. I began by asking Chris exactly what happened.
There was basically a party taking place at the home of an Hasidic rabbi in New York, just north of New York City, in a place called Mosey. And there were dozens of people there. And as they were celebrating, chatting, as they were enjoying themselves in the house, this man walked in. He seems to have hidden a knife inside an umbrella. And then he took out this large knife and just started to stab people all around him. Now, 5 people have been injured. Some of them have been stabbed multiple times and they are still being treated in hospital. And we've heard these detailed and very disturbing accounts of the attack itself. It has really affected people in that neighbourhood.
What do we know about the man who's been charged?
His name is Grafton Thomas. He's 37 and from Greenwood Lake in New York. He has actually already appeared in court. And there he pleaded not guilty to 5 counts of attempted murder and 1 count of burglary. He is being held in custody at this stage. Bail has been set at $5 million.
And we were hearing there about the more general rise in anti-Semitic incidents. Just put this into that context for us, Chris.
Yeah, in terms of New York in particular, there is concern. I think on a wider US basis as well, there is no doubt that the Jewish community is very worried about what's been happening. Just over a year ago, there was a mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania that people will remember, in which 11 people died. There was also a shooting in a synagogue earlier this year in San Diego. And indeed, there was an attack in New Jersey just earlier this month in which many people say it was fueled by anti-Semitism. It was a specific attack on a kosher supermarket. Market there. But in New York in particular, it's been a range of different kinds of attacks. Some of them just assault in the street, people being attacked, being punched, and then this kind of an attack that is very, very specific. And the New York Police Department has stepped up patrols to try and counter all of this. But if you listen to the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo today, he was saying, as far as he's concerned, this is domestic terrorism. He was saying that hate crime needs to be dealt with. And he even said that he wants New York to become the first US state to actually have a specific domestic terrorism law.
Chris Buckler, our correspondent in the United States. Detectives in North London are trying to establish who sprayed anti-Semitic graffiti on nearly a dozen shop fronts and a synagogue. The Star of David appeared on properties in Hampstead and Belsize Park on Saturday night, alongside a reference to the September the 11th terror attacks. A local councillor, Oliver Cooper, says he's shocked.
I've had to have a few incidents, isolated incidents of graffiti cleaned up before. It's the first time I've seen anything on this scale. One Jewish resident even compared it to Kristallnacht. And it's really vital that when they compare it to some of the greatest atrocities conducted against the Jewish people in history, we take the Jewish community's concerns seriously.
London Councillor Oliver Cooper. Prader-Willi syndrome is a little-known genetic disorder which causes patients to experience constant hunger and a desire to eat uncontrollably. Sufferers often have other problems such as diabetes, and many die before they reach the age of 20. Cuba has recently held an international conference on this disorder. There are only a handful of families with the condition on the communist-run island. But a combination of the US economic embargo and decades of economic mismanagement have made caring for Prader-Willi patients there even harder. From Havana, our correspondent Will Grant reports.
The fridge in Hector Fernandez's home is under lock and key. Not only the fridge, the door to the kitchen, which they had to have specially installed, is also locked. So are all the cupboards and the medicine cabinet. In fact, anywhere that contains anything that's remotely edible is carefully guarded. It's not that Hector is obsessive or paranoid. It's because his 18-year-old son, Christian, has a rare genetic condition called Prader-Willi syndrome, in which, if unsupervised, he could effectively eat himself to death. Prader-Willi patients suffer from a constant insatiable hunger. It's an incurable disorder which stems from a mutation of chromosome 15. Patients become obese, get diabetes or other life-threatening health issues. The syndrome also causes mental development and behavioural problems. When I met him at home, Christian was happy, friendly and calm. But his father showed me a harrowing video of how he can fly into a rage over food. Hector compared it to a Category 5 hurricane, as Prader-Willi patients can self-harm or be violent towards their parents when denied access to food. In the video, Christian's parents had taken the upsetting step of tying him to a padded chair. The rare condition is hugely punishing on patients and their caregivers alike. I just try to take things one day at a time, says Hector through the tears. I don't know what will happen to him after I'm gone, he adds, echoing a common concern for parents of Prader-Willi children. And the complications of the disease are especially compounded in Cuba.
Another problem that we've been hit by is that, being a rare illness, there are very few doctors in the country who have ever seen any patients with it. They might have seen one case in 20 years, and then never seen another. So there is no specialist here. In other countries, they can be admitted to hospital for a week at a time and will be seen by a nutritionist, psychologist, psychiatrist, dietitian, physiotherapist, all of them specialists in this disease. That's not the case here, though.
To regulate Christian's sugar and fat intake, Hector has him on a macrobiotic diet. Not easy on an island crippled by a US trade embargo and years of economic mismanagement.
Hector's just preparing lunch for Christian. Raw vegetables, lettuce, celery, and rice cakes of whole wheat rice. Things that are very difficult to find in Cuba.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to formally open this conference.
However, things are improving in some ways. Recently, Cuba hosted the 10th International Prader-Willi Conference, which brings together experts from different scientific disciplines, patients and family members to share their experiences. Professor Tony Holland is the president of the International Prader-Willi Syndrome Organization.
For me, the most important aspect of the conference is to get families and clinicians and scientists and caregivers talking together, particularly those from very different backgrounds, from different countries, some countries that have very good services, some countries that have no services or very poor services, to learn from each other so that people can go back home and they can argue for better services, they can argue for the right treatment for their children.
As the emeritus professor at Cambridge University's Department of Psychiatry, Tony Holland has seen the state of Prader-Willi care in many parts of the world. Despite the challenges in Cuba's healthcare system, he says he did see some encouraging signs on his trip.
Cuba now has the ability in their health service to do the genetic diagnosis. Their doctors are beginning to recognise Prader-Willi syndrome. There is a community of families of people with Prader-Willi syndrome, and that is really important. And that's what we see in other countries in the world, that once you have a family, you have some professionals that become interested, you have early diagnosis, you have people coming together as a group to fight for and to argue for the needs of people with Prader-Willi syndrome, then things get much better.
At the conference, a group of young Prader-Willi patients participated in a dance class, with movement and exercise crucial to their constant battle against obesity and diabetes. With Hector and Christian attending the event, they spent time with some of the other 100 or so Cuban families facing the same daily struggle. Cuba has a long way to go before its doctors understand this little-known condition, and meanwhile those affected are building a network of support to share ways to manage their unique, exhausting situation.
And that was Will Grant reporting from Cuba. Now, this week, the BBC World Service is celebrating the best of its podcasts from 2019. Here's Jackie.
A world of wonder.
That's just crazy to try to do something as dangerous as that around the moon.
Moments of joy.
What you should see now is a cloud.
No way.
A world of drama.
We don't have to be afraid now. Look at us.
And real life, too.
This is maybe the first lead of evidence we have in almost 48 years.
Amazing stories.
They hugged me and they started crying. They squeezed me and they were crying.
From all over our sphere.
There's nothing that you can't do in this world if you set your mind to it.
Shall we do it all again? Next year. Podcasts from the BBC World Service. Search for BBC World Service wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Jackie. Tens of thousands of people in the Australian state of Victoria have been told to evacuate as bushfires in the region intensify. Officials have warned that Monday will be a day of extreme danger as temperatures of more than 40 Celsius combine with thunderstorms and a change of wind direction. There's particular concern around East Gippsland, a popular tourist area near Melbourne, where three large fires are burning in a drought-hit forest. The warning comes at the same time as the Mayor of Sydney said the city's famous New Year fireworks display would go ahead despite calls for it to be cancelled because of the widespread bushfires. More than 250,000 people have signed a petition saying the money involved will be better spent on the firefighting effort. Linda McCormick set up the petition.
Australians, please have some respect for the people of Australia that are really suffering. It's not ideal to send more smoke up into the air. I am really, really getting angry. It's never too late. They've just got to have the guts to do it.
For more on that row, here's our correspondent Phil Mercer in Sydney.
It's arguably the world's most dazzling fireworks display. But thousands of people want Sydney to scrap its New Year's Eve spectacular. They say it would be an insult and could traumatise some of those affected by the bushfire crisis. Sydney's Lord Mayor Clover Moore said she shared the deep sympathies of those who'd signed the petition, but stressed that the fireworks were planned months in advance and most of the budget had already been spent.
So, barring catastrophic fire conditions in Sydney on New Year's Eve, the event seems certain to go ahead. In between now and then, the authorities are warning of severe to extreme fire dangers across much of southeastern Australia, much of the heavily populated parts of Australia. That includes South Australia, Victoria, Tasmania and New South Wales, where more than 80 fires continue to burn.
And for the latest on those fires, putting the state of Victoria under particular threat, I've been speaking to Henry Bellow.
Well, we know that firefighters are very concerned about the Gippsland region. That's to the east of Melbourne. There are three fires that are out of control there, and temperatures are tipped to reach 40 degrees with strong wind and even dry lightning in the next couple of days. Now, these conditions are challenging enough for firefighters, but this area is extremely popular with tourists. In one region, in one city, Lake's Entrance, there are 30,000 tourists there. But the real concern for authorities is that there's now only one major road into this region. Fire has closed the other two roads, and if this last road closes, then tens of thousands of people are going to be stranded in danger. And that's why the state's fire commissioner has taken the unusual step of telling people to leave now while there's still a road. It might sound quite alarmist, but this is really about trying to be prepared to avoid panic and pressure on that one main road. It is the biggest evacuation in Australian history, or certainly one of the biggest, but some people at this stage are continuing with their holiday plans. They don't appear to be particularly alarmed.
Henry Bellow reporting. The West African country of Guinea-Bissau held a runoff presidential election on Sunday, which election observers say went smoothly. Both candidates are former prime ministers. The two men have promised to bring stability to the country, which since independence from Portugal in 1974 has suffered 9 coup attempts, some of them successful. But what chance of change? Here's our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
difficult to know if there's going to be great change, but people are obviously hoping that there are brighter days ahead in a country which really has had an appalling history when it comes to those coups and coup attempts. And just to try and get underneath the skin a bit and look at why it's so unstable. One of the reasons, as I say, is because this governing party has been there on its own ruling. There have also been, there's been a lot of overlap really between the military and the politicians, and the military is not really subordinate often to the politicians, so that leads to crises which often come around the times of elections. And after the 2012 coup, international peacekeepers from West Africa were deployed, so that helped a bit. But, you know, over the last term of the current president, there's been a complete political crisis within the governing party, with Parliament not even sitting for 2 years. So that gives you an idea of how chaotic the politics is. And then throw on top of that, during the early 2000s, the UN basically declared Guinea-Bissau a narco state. In other words, the cocaine industry was so heavily rooted inside the political elite, and there were, it was seen as the major transit point for drugs coming from Latin America going into Europe. And it's such a poor country that the drugs had basically taken over the state, and it became, you know, a narco state. Things have got a bit better now, but it's still incredibly poor, and it'll take a miracle for the next president to turn it around.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. For the last 3 years, perhaps the most famous clock in the world has been pretty much silent. The Elizabeth Tower that supports Big Ben at the eastern end of the Palace of Westminster in central London is being renovated. Now, that means lashings of gold leaf and new stonework and an overhaul of the clock mechanism, which goes back to the 19th century. Twice a year, on the day Britain remembers its war dead, and at midnight on New Year's Eve, the bells still ring out across central London. Our correspondent Johnny Diamond has been to the tower to find out more.
It's fabulously grey, drizzly day, and I'm right next to the clock tower, which is completely covered in scaffolding and an exterior staircase. I'm snuggled up against that famous warm sandstone that makes up the rest of the palace, and we are in a childhood dream come true, because that's what happens around Christmas. Going to go up the clock tower.
So I'm Charlotte Clawson, I'm the senior project leader. I work for Strategic Estates, which is the department within the Parliamentary Estate, and this is one of my projects, so this is the refurbishment of Elizabeth Tower.
Is now the right time to tell you I really hate heights?
Yeah.
The lift is coming down now. I really hate heights. I really regret doing this. I hope it's worth it. We are going up and up and up. And we're still going up. Oh. Thank you. There's a sign up here saying, please don't touch the gold, as it will cause damage. Down at eye level, there's gold paint on the lettering that's carved in. And then, oh my gosh, and here is one of the clock faces. Which clock face are we looking at?
We're looking at the east one currently, so overlooking the embankment. This is the original colour scheme. So you'll see here that it's very blue.
Very blue, and then obviously the sort of interior circle is gold, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's also gold leaf, just like the stone carving around. It's all been hand-gilded.
Fabulous. Right, where are we going?
So we're going to take you down. We're going to go to down the belfry, again, where Big Ben resides.
Big Ben, excellent. Right, up the stairs. Now in the belfry.
Home to Big Ben himself.
Is Big Ben.
We have five bells. Big Ben is only one of them. We have four other quarter bells, and they are
smaller.
So they do the Westminster chimes.
And oh, they're here. And like, we see that they're sort of dotted around Big it. Ben. Are the they bells. Small Ben? Sorry.
I don't believe they're individually named, but we will check with our architect and come back to you. Okay. So the bells, actually, we have done no work to, and we don't intend on doing any work as part of this project. For the majority of the time, they are protected because the mechanism which actually drives the bells we have taken out. It's one of the reasons why you don't hear Big Ben striking. However, we will strike Big Ben for Remembrance Sunday and New Year's Eve. So what you can see in front of you is a temporary motor. This will drive Big Ben. So when you hear the 12 strikes at midnight, on the 31st of December, this is what is powering the hammer.
Back into the outside, leaving the belfry.
We are currently at the Ayrton Light level of Elizabeth Tower. So the Ayrton Light shines whenever the House of Commons or House of Lords is sitting. So above us, you can see right up to the top. So you can see the cross and orb.
How much of this tower do you think gets seen by the public? I mean, it's beautifully done, but does anyone apart from rather brave pigeons get to see them?
I think the answer is yes. It was, before we put the scaffolding, in the most Instagram location in the UK, as our Director General takes great delight in telling us we ruined that stat for him. So yes, it is seen, and yeah, actually, although we have the privilege of being so up close and from the ground, it's equally stunning. Yeah. As you say, it's grey and overcast, but when the sun is shining, even now,
yeah,
it's just yeah, magical, and it really is an honour to be able to restore this to its former glory.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Our correspondent, Johnny Diamond, reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, do drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.